Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so excited to sit down with the incredible home cook, food equity advocate, host of the Keep Calm and Cook podcast, and prolific cookbook author, Julia Tertian. Julia has been writing cookbooks for years. She's collaborated with massive names like Gwyneth Paltrow, Mark Bittman, and Jean George, and put out 4 cookbooks of her own. In total, Julia has worked on 15. In 2016, her first solo cookbook, Small Victories, was an immediate hit, named as one of the best cookbooks of the year by NPR and the New York Times. Julia's second book, Feed the Resistance, came out just a year later and was deemed Eater's Best Cookbook of 2017. And her third book, Now and Again, was both Amazon's Best Cookbook of 2018 and an NPR Great Read. Now, Julia is releasing her highly anticipated 4th book, Simply Julia, which comes out tomorrow, March 2nd. With an emphasis on healthy comfort food, this book is full, like 110 recipes full, of the unfussy yet deeply satisfying meals Julia is famous for, with a focus on affordable and accessible ingredients, and let me tell you, it is beautifully done. But before Julia began writing books of her own, she held a variety of other jobs in the food world, and a lot of them, specifically as a private chef. She's here to bring us through her winding culinary journey, from everything she learned cooking in the homes of her many clients, to bringing to life celebrated books that inspire people to cook in their own homes. Now, on Second Life, it's Julia Tertian. So, Julia, we like to start by taking it way back to the beginning. What did you study in school, and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So in college, I studied poetry, but earlier than that, like through middle school and high school, I just basically have always loved food, and I've loved cooking, and I've loved writing about food. So in those years when I, you know, was assigned, you know, book reports or whatever, I was always writing about what the characters in the books were eating. Like anywhere food appeared, I was writing about it. So yeah, you know, press fast forward, and then I went to college and I studied poetry, and I was writing a lot of, I think, pretty awful, but like extremely earnest poetry that a lot of it was about food and was about cooking and was about how I feel when I'm eating and cooking and all these things, you know, all the things I still continue to do. So I think it was actually a very useful education. And I kind of have this theory that every recipe I write, I approach it the same way I would write a poem. You know, it's a pretty standard format, but the fun is in shaking up the format a little bit. And they're both about writing something extremely descriptive, but also being very economic with your language.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it really was like actually an amazing education for what I do. But this all might just be me trying to justify spending, you know, quite a lot of money on studying something that doesn't have like a great financial return on the investment. But anyway, yeah.
I don't think that you're grasping at straws. I think there is a clear correlation between the two. I was actually thinking about it the second you said poetry. I was like, oh, well, you have to do a lot with a little for poetry. And that's kind of the same thing with recipes as well. So I think it's quite apt. So when you were in school, you did a lot of internships. You worked a lot. You interned for a food magazine, a cookbook author, and a food show TV producer. So tell me, first of all, what was it like doing all of these internships and having all of these work experiences? And what did you learn about what you liked and what you didn't like?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so much privilege, and I'm so grateful to have had those experiences. You know, I went to college in New York City, and I'll back up just a little further, which is I grew up, both my parents worked in publishing. They worked primarily in the magazine business. So I grew up around print media, you know, and when I said earlier, I've known for so long I've wanted to work on cookbooks. I mean, I really mean that from such a young age, like before I could really even read, I was like flipping through cookbooks and just like enjoying looking at the photos. You know, I've always been really drawn to them. And part of that is because they were around, you know, they were in my home. I was exposed to them. And I also had just like a lot of connections from my upbringing, which I just think is really important to mention, because I think anytime when I'm asked about my career, so many people are like, you know, how did you get your foot in the door? And part of me feels like I was already inside, you know? So I think I learned a lot about basically just not being afraid to ask when you don't know something. Mm. I'm thinking about specifically like my first day. So I was an intern at Food and Wine magazine in college, and I showed up on my first day and they said that they were going to be starting like an annual cocktail guide, which was like a small book that they produced. And I came in, I met with the, you know, editor I was going to be interning under. She told me about what they were making. And then I think asked me to look up, you know, maybe it was like drinks they had covered or something like that, whatever it was. But I was never told where to sit or if there was a computer I was supposed to use. And I'm not like that old, but I'm old enough that I wasn't walking in with my own laptop ready to go. Like I came with a pen.
Right.
And so I think I went to like their library of their old issues. I just remember sitting on the floor with a ton of magazines going through them, and a legal pad is basically the end of the story. And I hand wrote all these notes, and I just was scared to kind of ask someone what I was supposed to do. You know, I got the assignment, but I didn't understand the logistics of it. And then I went to that editor with, you know, I don't know, 4 pages of handwritten notes. And she just was so amused by this. And she was like, well, I mean, good for you for like getting it done, but we need to like type this up. And I was like, great. Is there a computer I can use? And, you know, I have a lot of compassion for my younger self. But I feel like I have a lot of stories like that from all those internships and kind of early experiences where they just all basically taught me that, like, if you don't know the answer to the question, there's no shame in asking the question.
I think that's a wonderful point, though, because as someone who also started her career interning and working at fashion magazines in New York, there wasn't a culture of ask questions. Like, mm-hmm. you were not, it was very like, you should be seen and not spoken to. Like, you should mm-hmm. somehow just know how to do things. I think that people now in internships understand that you're there to learn and to help and to have those questions. And managers are more equipped to set their interns up for success. But it was very just like sink or swim back in the day. At least that was my experience as well.
Yeah, definitely. That definitely like feels familiar. And I think just that feeling of the scarcity mentality that I think so many of us have in so many different industries, you know, that feeling of like, wow, this is such a big opportunity that I'm here. Like, I don't want to mess this up if I say I don't know something. And like, the reason you're there is to learn things. And you're also there to help them get things done. And, you know, there's just such a tremendous lack of, transparency in publishing. And I feel like the older I get or the more jaded I get, I don't know, maybe a mixture of both. My goal is to like make things as transparent as possible.
The gatekeeping is real for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So right out of school, you went to Spain to work on a project with one of the producers for whom you had interned. And that experience led you to writing your first book. I need the full Spain story, please. How did that unfold? What was that like?
So yeah, the producer I had worked part-time for during college, he was putting together a show, a PBS show about Spain, traveling around Spain. And it was hosted by 4 people. It was hosted by Mark Bittman and Mario Batali and Gwyneth Paltrow and Claudia Bassols, who is a very lovely Spanish actress. And I was hired to be not the writer of the companion book to the show, but the assistant to the writer of the companion book to the show. And when I said yes to that, I mean, I didn't even know the things I should be thinking about or asking for, things like, how long will I be going? Or how much money will I be paid? Or like, is there a contract? Or like, what do you expect from the writer's assistant? I was just told like, Spain, now, go, yes or no, you know, like, and I was like, oh my gosh, yes, like I have nothing to lose. And so it's not the kind of project I think I would so quickly say yes to right now, but I'm so glad I did then, because I think I basically learned to like ski on ice. And it was two trips, if I remember correctly. I think the first was like a month and the second was close to a month, coming back home to New York in between for a little bit. And basically I got like a crash course, sort of like master's education in making like a PBS cooking travel show. You know, I traveled around with the whole crew and I was there always with my notebook and I would just write everything down. And no one told me to do that. And I kind of didn't quite realize that in the process, that is like how you write a book. Obviously, you write a book by writing things down, but really chronicling this trip and everything that was happening. And when someone was cooking something, I would write down what they were doing. And then we had footage, you know, later I could look back on and see exactly how many, you know, onions went into the pot or whatever it was. So I had this log of notes. And basically the guy who I was assisting ended up leaving the project. And there was this moment of being pretty close to this book deadline and this question of like, well, what are we going to do now? And then I, you know, was there as I always was with my notebooks. And I was like, I think we're good. Like, I think I've got this. Let me finish this. And I would every night, wherever we were staying and we were constantly traveling, I would type up all these notes. So I had them in like, a, you know, a Word doc or whatever, and basically got to turn that into that book. And that was the first book I worked on. So it was with some pretty, you know, big people and stuff. And that book led to kind of everything else. And it really was, when I think back now, I really can't quite believe like it all happened, but it did. And it was a really formative experience. Yeah.
Very much so. Also, what a great meet cute with Gwyneth Paltrow.
Totally.
So what was your biggest learning curve in that project and what was your biggest takeaway?
You know, I think that they are one in the same. I think it's about asking for credit. That's the thing that's like ringing true in my head. And I, because basically towards the end of creating this book, there was an amazing designer who worked on the book, Douglas Riccardi, who I'm still really friendly with, and he's just a super talented graphic designer. And I worked very closely with him, you know, after the manuscript was done, because there were like thousands of photos. There was a great photographer on the trip. And the photos, if I remember correctly, like weren't labeled or organized. And so I like would sit for hours with Douglas going through, you know, which photos belong where and stuff. And anyway, he had designed the cover and the title page of the book. And I remember thinking, I would like my name to be there. And
right.
So I remember summoning all the like bravery I could. And we had a meeting about something else. And I was like, before everyone left, I was like, hey, can I just like bring up one last thing? And I like had the title page from the designer. And I was like, I would really like to have my name on here. And I was so
because
nervous.
I did all of the work.
Yeah. And I like, I mean, I'm thinking back now, I like feel my heart rate going up now telling you the story. This was so long ago, but I was so nervous. And they were all like, oh, sure. Yeah. Like add it, you know, go for it. And it was such, I mean, such a learning curve about, I think, standing up for myself. And I think the takeaway was the fact that they were all so easygoing about it when I asked, and I just realized like, oh, none of them were going to think of that. Like this was not important to them. No one was going to knock on my door and say, hey, Julia, like we want to put your name on the title page. Like, what do you think about that? Like that wasn't going to happen. Like I had to ask for it. And learning that the worst thing that could happen was they would say no, I had to ask. And that has really led me, you know, I guess that's the same answer I had to your first question about the internship. If you don't know something, ask. I think asking for credit and for recognition, which often gets intertwined with, you know, standing up for oneself, I think that was definitely like my big takeaway. And I think back to that like moment a lot because it was really, I'm just really glad I asked. I think a lot of things might be different had I not.
Yeah, I'll say. And it's such a hard thing to do for women, I think in particular, for young people not wanting to overstep their boundaries and wanting to be respectful of the project. But also it's this crazy thing where I know for myself, I've waited for other people to anoint me, to recognize me, to give me the money, to give me the title, to give me the credit. Because I think if I show up and I work hard, someone will notice and that will be that. And that's just not the way the world works. Like, you have to ask for yourself and you won't always get it. But at least by asking, you're also stating your intentions to the people around you. You're saying, I think this is what I'm worth. And I think that's so important and really amazing that you learned that lesson at such a young age. I mean, I'm 41 and I feel like I'm barely in internalizing that. So
yeah,
tip of the hat to you, well, Julia.
I appreciate that. And I also think I think about the fact that I was asking that question to a room of people who I knew liked me. We had like a good working relationship. I also was sitting at that table as a white woman in an industry that's full of white women. And, you know, and I was sitting at that table coming from my upbringing, which was I was raised by editors, by people who get to make those kinds of decisions. And I had that kind of like insider knowledge. And I think about how scared I was to ask, but I had all of that going for me, right? So I can only imagine how someone who doesn't have that kind of access and agency that I had, like how they would feel in that situation. So
right.
That's also something I really carry with me. And I think really informs my desire to try to ask people what they need before they ask me for something like as much as I can, or to just really listen with as open ears as possible when asked about something. Because yeah, I just think about like that was just such a tough moment for me, but I also had a lot to make that moment a lot easier for me than it may have been for someone else.
Right. The privilege of confidence that comes from knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you come back to the States after this amazing time in Spain. You work on the book and you started working as a private chef as well to supplement your income. How did that happen? How did that happen?
Yeah, great question. it was right in between. I mentioned that Spain project, it was two trips to Spain. And I think there was maybe, I don't know, a month or two in between. And I was back in New York City and I needed money.
You were broke.
Yes, that would be the word. I was talking to like a family friend. I think we were at like her son's birthday party. And she was like, well, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I'm going back to Spain for this sort of like amazing opportunity. But like in the meantime, twiddling my thumbs. And she was like, oh, my friend is looking for someone to cook for her family. Like, would you want to do that? And I said, sure.
What did you know about cooking for a family?
Well, I knew I had spent so many years as like a teenager, basically cooking at home for my family. And I had cooked all through college. And I showed up when I lived in the dorm my freshman year, I showed up with a toolbox filled with like a wooden spoon and a whisk. And
what?
Like, I've just always been cooking at home. And one summer, I think maybe after my junior year of college or something, I took a week-long catering intensive course at the New School. So that meant like every day I was taking the train into the city and going into this commercial kitchen with, I think it was maybe a group of like a dozen people. And I was the youngest by like many decades. And I just remember on the first day, the instructor said, you know, if the people in your life, you know, give you a hard time because you make so many lists, like you have found your place. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have found my people. Like, I'm home. So I took like a bread baking course at the French Culinary Institute. It goes by a different name now. So I was like constantly seeking these moments of just education. And I just grew up watching cooking shows on PBS like all day every day and Great Chefs on the Discovery Channel. And, you know, it was like the first thing I did when I came home from school, and I just devoured cookbooks. Like I couldn't fall asleep if I didn't read a cookbook. So I've been cooking like my whole life, and that cooking has been cooking at home. It's been home cooking. So I did what I guess seems to be a theme in my life. I just said yes and assumed I would kind of figure it out. And so I went to this woman's apartment. She gave me a key to the apartment, and, you know, we set a fee, and I honestly can't remember what it was, but I would go cook in their apartment. And I think I did it like a few days a week, and I would do it when no one was there. And I would leave, you know, the pot on the stove with the flame turned off, or I would, you know, leave something in the fridge or stuff on the counter. And I would leave a note with the best way for them to heat this thing up. And I loved it. It meant that I could basically grocery shop with someone else's money, which is like the most fun thing to do. And I could cook in this really beautiful kitchen. So I got to do this thing I love, and she gave me money in exchange, and it was awesome. And it was like the best part-time job. And that basically led to all the other private chef work I've done. It's all been like word of mouth and like, oh, hey, my friend is having a birthday party. Like, would you cook for that? And on and on and on.
So tell me about this private chefing. I assume there are lots of different kinds of jobs that you could have. I'm curious about what sort of the life of a private chef looks like. Mm-hmm. And I know there are lots of variables.
Yeah, there are so many, and I've done it many different ways. So I have done what I just described to you, which was, to me, is like the ideal, like a key to an empty, like beautiful New York apartment and someone else's credit card. Like, that's the best. So I started out doing it like the coziest way, which I didn't quite realize. And that food would be informed by a lot of conversation and really getting in touch with what people's needs were, which is something I continue to, you know, be incredibly curious about. And so that was one way to sort of do that kind of cooking, which was great because I wasn't serving anything and I wasn't having to time anything to like when people sat down. It wasn't like entertaining and it wasn't sort of that kind of direct service. So that was one way of doing it, which I really enjoyed and I did for a lot of people. On the other end of the extreme, I've done living with a family for a month at a time in the Hamptons, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, they're having friends or family over.
Ooh, that sounds intense.
Yeah. Like I, this one family, I mean, they were lovely. I worked for them one summer. They were like in Montauk, basically, which if anyone listening doesn't know, it's the end of Long Island. So you just keep driving and you get there. And they had just moved into this new, really just quite enormous home. And this was actually like the most fun thing I ever did, which was I got to outfit their kitchen. So I got to basically go to Williams-Sonoma and they gave me whatever list they have for people who register there for their wedding. So I got to basically like marry myself.
I mean, that sounds absolutely dreamy.
Yeah. I mean, it was like pretty great. So I got to really set up this kitchen, but I would go back and forth. I think I worked for them like Thursdays through Sundays. I've kind of like blacked it out a little bit because it was like really intense. But I would go, I would take the jitney, which is the bus that goes from the city to Long Island. And I would take the jitney back and forth and be at my apartment Monday through Wednesday, like eating takeout and sleeping and then going back on the weekends and working, you know.
24.
Yeah.
Seven.
Like really, really intense. Breakfast for the kids at 6:30 in the morning, like parties at night. But while it was really grueling, it did pay way better than like any writing I was doing at the time. And it gave me this sort of steady income and stability. So that was like the other end of the extreme. But at the end of the day, I was always just cooking for people in their homes. And, you know, if someone wanted like a really fancy like restaurant meal made at home, like I was not the person they would hire. I basically made tons of Caesar salad and meatballs and
honest food,
like chili. And exactly. And it really allowed me to get in touch with what people, no matter their level of income or wealth or whatever, it let me get in touch with what people really want at home, which I really believe is to just feel taken care of. And I think that's what everyone wants. And, you know, I got to also,
what a research lab.
Yeah, totally. And the other thing that was pretty amazing was that, you know, I knew I didn't want to be a private chef for the rest of my life. Like, it's a really great job. I think it's one of the more flexible jobs. It's one of the more, you know, well-paying jobs, especially for women in food. Like, I think it's a really great option, but it wasn't what I was so passionate about that I wanted to do forever. But I felt like, wow, what an opportunity to be incredibly creative. And I set this rule for myself that I never told any client about. But my rule was, unless someone asked me to make something again, I tried to never repeat anything I cooked.
No repeats?
I really tried not to. And I kept track of everything I cooked. And I did that, you know, it goes back to me being the girl with the notebook to the side of the people making the big project, just keeping track of it all. And that happened in notebooks, that happened on the back of, you know, envelopes and napkins. So I, for years, had an email to myself that I would just keep replying to. And I wasn't writing down the recipes of what I was cooking, but I would write down, you know, the menu I made for that lunch or that dinner. And, you know, if there were any good notes about, I got access to this ingredient, so I used this and it turned out really well, whatever it was. If there was a good story there, I would write a little note to myself. And honestly, that email and those notebooks and stuff were very much like the table of contents in my first cookbook.
Wow.
It really did turn into that. And it was just this opportunity to flex my kind of home cooking muscle over and over again, you know, much more than I would ever cook for just myself at home, you know, at that age. So yeah, it wasn't like I had a book deal and I was like, okay, I'm going to private chef for like, you know, a bunch of years and turn this into a thing. It wasn't that
reverse
at all.
Engineer it.
Yeah. But it just felt very, if this isn't what you love to do more than anything, but it's connected to what you love to do, like let it serve that thing in some way.
So at the same time that you're doing this, you're also collaborating on or co-authoring a whole slew of cookbooks on topics ranging from Vietnamese food to a book about breads from around the world. I mean, it's like an insane amount of subject matter to wrap your head around, let alone be an authority on. Did you feel comfortable in all of these different cuisines and techniques before you accepted various jobs? Or would you say yes to a project and then do a deep dive into the subject? What was that process like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think within your question, I feel like there's like a really important distinction because I, to this day, do not feel like an authority on any of those things. What I feel, I guess, an authority on is knowing how to put together a cookbook, knowing how to write a really solid recipe, knowing how to test a recipe, knowing how to structure a cookbook and give it a cadence, and knowing how to keep track of just 1 million details from the way the text is laid out on the page to how an image is cropped next to it. And well, to answer your question, I basically just said yes to everything because
I had a hunch.
I mean, I love cookbooks. I love making them. I love refining the process every single time I make them because there's just not a formula. And I'm looking right now at a Post-it that I keep above my desk. One of my closest friends, Amelia, used to work in art book publishing. And she said to me one day that the only reason books are done are because they're due.
Yeah.
And this is something I look at every day. So yeah, basically when it's done, it's done. And I think that is something that actually does attract me to the work I do because I work really intensely and I don't think I could work that way if it was
in perpetuity.
Yeah. And I think I need the deadline and I need to know that at a certain point, it's just going to be as good as it can possibly be. And then it's over. And
yeah.
I think that's been, I don't know, for better or worse, a big part of my, I guess, just life. Like it's been this cycle of, you know, intensity followed by some what I've come to understand are the post-book blues, like when you turn something in, and then the feeling of like, oh, am I ever going to work again? And then all of a sudden you're working again. And it doesn't happen this way all the time for everyone. But for me, it has been this cycle. And for me, learning to really appreciate the kind of valleys in between the peaks has been really, really important. Yeah.
So you've collaborated with some very serious heavy hitters in the industry, everyone from Jean George to the aforementioned Gwyneth Paltrow, so many people. What are some of the most pivotal or standout experiences or projects that you've had in that collaborative space?
Yeah, I mean, I've been so fortunate to work with just such a range of people. And not just a range of people, but a range of topics from bread baking to Korean food to Vietnamese food, all these different things. So I've gotten to learn so much so quickly about so many different people in so many parts of the world. But in terms of like experiences that really stand out to me, it was working with the chef Jody Williams on her book Bouvette, which is also the name of her restaurant. And working with Jody was, It was like, I felt like I was exactly where I needed to be when I needed to be there. And I essentially had come off of a ton of travel for my work between the cookbooks I was working on, ones with PBS shows, which included a lot of travel. I was doing a ton of private chefing, which included a lot of travel. I said to like one of my best friends, I have such great boundaries between my work and my life. Like, I don't talk to anyone I work for about anything in my personal life. And then my friend, who continues to be one of my best friends and who I love so much, she was like, Julia, you don't have a personal life. Like, she was like, it's not that you have boundaries. Like, there's nothing to put a wall up for. And it just like really hit me. And I was at a moment where I wanted to be home and I wanted to figure out what that word home even meant to me. I think it wasn't a mistake I got wrapped up in so much work and travel. I think I was running around the world and trying to outrun myself in some ways. And I think part of that was just really embracing myself as a gay woman. I think I just hadn't quite wrap my head around that. And I just was ready to get to know myself and get to feel a sense of home just in myself. And I then got an email from Jody Williams's literary agent saying she was on contract to do this book and she needed someone to help her finish it. And the deadline was fast approaching. And I, at the time, had just moved to this apartment that was in walking distance of Bouvet. And I...
Kismet.
Yeah, I mean, it truly, truly was. And I replied to the agent and she was like, when can you meet with Jody? And I was like, I mean, I could be there in 5 minutes. And she was like, great, go. And I had been a patron of Bouvet. It's like one of the most special little spaces in New York City. And Jody and I just got along immediately. And it was a pretty short turnaround. I think we had like 3 or 4 months to finish the book. And her now spouse, Rita, who they together run just the best restaurant in New York, Via Carota, it was before they opened that. And Rita had her restaurant, Isodi, which, I mean, these mm-hmm. are like all the best places. But at the time, Isodi was only open for dinner. And so I basically, multiple times a week, got to go during the day to Isodi with Jody Williams while she cooked in Rita's kitchen. And I got to just watch her cook and I got to take notes and I got to ask her about all the stories while she was doing it. And then Rita would put down like bowls of spaghetti for us to eat. And it was a dream. It was like a true dream. And what was really amazing, I mean, I think Jody is like the best cook, or Rita is, the two of them are, I can't decide, but they both have such an incredible sense of style and their restaurants are amazing and they're just so much fun. And Jody's like one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. But each of those things would be like a great takeaway. But for me, I got to sit up close and center to this couple that was just showing me what it looked like to be in this beautiful relationship between two women and to treat each other with respect and so much care and to make each other laugh and to make good food for each other. And I just felt like I got to see, oh, this is the thing that's missing. This is what I actually long for. Like, the work is great. It's great to put my name on whatever page or cover, sure. But like, this is what I want. And it's not a surprise to me that very, very soon after we finished working on that book, I met my now wife, Grace. And I think I got to really see the kind of life I really wanted for myself reflected in Jody and Rita's relationship. And it continues to be just one of the most meaningful experiences of my life and really set me up to consider what a life could look like that was a bit more whole and wasn't just about my work.
Julia, I don't even know you and you're making me cry over here.
Well, I mean, I get choked up thinking about it because I really, it was an extraordinary experience. That was just such a gift. I'll go back to that word, to get to work with her. I cherish those memories very much.
So you mentioned that you left New York, which happened in 2014. Tell me about that decision. Yeah.
So worked with Jody on that book. That book is great. Please get it. The recipes are so good. And then I met my wife, Grace. And so I basically just wrote to Grace. So Grace used to run a website called Design Sponge. Mm-hmm. And she wrote this really wonderful, short and sweet coming out post. And I was sitting alone in my apartment. It was like late at night. I like read it. I think I like had made myself a cocktail or something. And I was like, what do I have to lose? And I wrote her an email and like asked her out. And
Julia,
it's kind of like the asking for credit thing. I was like, okay, worst thing that happens is she doesn't reply.
I love this.
And then met soon after. And we got married 4 months to the day after. And yeah, so it was like super lesbian cliche, like U-Haul truck showed up. But
hey, you know, when you know, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And cliches exist because they're true and whatever. So anyway, the queer community is not a monolith. I will say that. So that was our story. And so she had, before we were together, she had spent a lot of time in various parts of the Hudson Valley and like the Catskills region of New York. And we spent our honeymoon up here, and then we like rented a house over the summer for like a few weeks. And we wanted to just continue to sort of build our life and home together. And we both have always worked from home. You know, moving out of the city didn't involve like a career transition at all. In fact, for me, it's been a huge benefit because I now have a larger kitchen and a dishwasher. And these things have really made a difference. So yeah, that's where we are.
And then in 2016, you published your first solo cookbook, Small Victories, Recipes, Advice, and Hundreds of Ideas for Home Cooking Triumphs, which became one of NPR and the New York Times Best Cookbooks of the Year. I bought it after hearing you interviewed on NPR, I think. It is still one of my favorites. The meatballs in particular have been a go-to in our house for quite some time. It's so, so wonderful. Obviously, you'd had a lot of experience cooking. You'd had a lot of experience writing cookbooks. You'd had a lot of experience in general, writing everything. But this is just something that's all yours. Was the process different? Were there any unexpected challenges? Or did it go the way you thought it would?
I would say the process of making the book was honestly just incredibly efficient because I didn't have to schedule time with anyone else. But in terms of making the book, like I wouldn't say the experience was so, so different than working with other people, but definitely a lot more kind of quiet, I think would be the right word, more in touch kind of with myself. The thing that was really different, which I really didn't wrap my head around until I experienced it, was yes, I had gone into my first book having worked on so many other books. You know, I felt very confident in my ability to produce a cookbook. What I had never experienced was promoting a book and that side of being an author, which is just as much work. And it was the logistics of that side of the work. I just didn't realize how much it would be. I think I also didn't know how incredibly gratifying it would be to just now hear, you know, you make the meatballs. That's amazing to me. You know, those meatballs are very near and dear. They were like the first thing I cooked for Grace. I shared that story in the book. And I mean, I think that recipe, it's the turkey and ricotta meatball recipe.
Yep.
I think it's easily like the most popular recipe from that book, which makes me so happy because they're so important to me. And that's the point of a cookbook, right? Like we get this opportunity to share ourselves and our stories. And so seeing that that recipe gets, you know, made so often and shared is incredibly meaningful to me. So that kind of sense of gratification was not something I anticipated. You know, in the past, my gratification came from turning it in, turning it in on time, but not the feeling of having someone actually make my recipes. And with that, also know that they've read these stories. That is huge and continues to be really meaningful.
So you have really done a lot in a very short period of time. So that book came out in 2016. And then the following year, you published Feed the Resistance, Recipes and Ideas for Getting Involved, and you donated the proceeds to the ACLU. And then the following year, you also debuted a book, Now and Again, Go-To Recipes, Inspired Menus, and Endless Ideas for Reinventing Leftovers, which was named the best cookbook of 2018 by Amazon and an NPR Great Read. Okay, so that's three cookbooks in 3 years. Plus, I'm sure other projects were overlapping. I'm both impressed and also a little bit scared. So what were you thinking to have that level of work? Obviously, I feel like you were seeking some balance. That doesn't seem like a very balanced schedule.
Yeah, how's that going?
From the outside, just saying.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it wasn't just those 3 years. It was the years preceding those that led to those 3 years, because a book doesn't happen overnight. That was like a pretty intense chapter for me. And the second of the three books wasn't really that planned. So basically, September of 2016 came out with Small Victories. People are making the meatballs. It's great, like wonderful experience. And I don't remember if I had pitched Now and Again right before Small Victories came out, but I had already made the proposal for it because I had long wanted to do a book about leftovers because I love leftovers and I'm just trying to convert people to Team Leftovers all the time. And so I had this idea for that book. I had, you know, a lot of recipes in mind for it. I had been working on the proposal. So yeah, September of 2016, my first solo cookbook comes out. Great experience. I'm already signing my contract for the next book. It feels like a dream. And then 2 months later, November of 2016, there was a presidential election. You may have heard.
Yes, I think I remember.
And I, like many other people, you know, had a lot of feelings when that happened. I would say mostly like a mixture of like rage and fear, like equal parts. And at the time of the election, I was kind of talking to a lot of local organizers in my area about what can I do and what can we all do? And people who have been doing this work for so long, you know, before it became so undeniable. And the advice I kept getting over and over was like, do not try and reinvent the wheel. Do not try to like start something. Plug into the things that already exist and plug into what you already do. And just do it with a different energy. So I did both those things. I plugged into things in my local community that already exist. And I thought about what I know how to do. And what I know how to do is put together a cookbook. So I sent my editor at the time a pretty simple one-page email saying, I have this idea, this sort of vision for this book called Feed the Resistance. I think it should be like this small book, something you would get someone for like a gift. It should include a ton of different contributors representing a wide range of things from a diversity of age and race and location, you know, not just everyone in New York or California, a diversity of professions within and around food, and just a diversity of perspectives. And I think that we should do this book right now. And I think that, you know, neither of us, me or my publisher, should make any money. I think that we should pay everyone who contributes. And then anything on top of that, we should donate all the proceeds to the ACLU. So I was asking a book publisher to do a book very quickly. And books take forever for people to make decisions about. So it's like a lot of hurry up and wait in publishing. So I was asking them to skip that and just say yes and get to it. And I was asking them to not just say yes to me, you know, who they already knew and worked with and, you know, I hope trusted, but to also say yes to over 20 people who I hadn't even asked yet and they hadn't worked with. And, you know, on top of that, like, let's not make any money here. And they immediately got it and they were like, go for it, run. And I got to pull together this incredible group of contributors to make this book. And I think to date, the book has raised something like $20,000, probably more. I haven't checked in a while for the ACLU, which was a larger contribution than I could have made alone. And most importantly, I think it really reached a lot of home cooks who I feel maybe not everyone understood how much power they had to make a difference in their own community. And they got to learn that not from me, but from everyone who contributed to that book. So yeah, that second book wasn't really planned, but it was obviously built with a lot of like passion and momentum. And it also happened really quickly. Like I put together the entire book like in a month. So yeah, and then I had Small Victories before and Now and Again after that, which just felt like maybe a lot less urgent, I would say. But you know, I got to just pour myself into those books, where Feed the Resistance was very much about being more of, I would say, like a project manager more than anything else.
You also founded Equity at the Table, which is a digital directory of women and gender nonconforming individuals in and around the food industry, and also primarily focuses on people of color and the LGBTQ community. So tell me a little bit about this initiative, why it was important to start it, and sort of the nuts and bolts of how you got it off the ground. My God, you're busy, Julia.
So it started just after Feed the Resistance came out. And I, as I mentioned, I had just come off of putting out Small Victories, which got like a lot of love from a lot of people. It got a lot of press. I mean, you mentioned you heard me talk about it on NPR. Like, that is a big deal for any author. And so I got the experience of putting myself out there, which is a super vulnerable, scary thing to do. And then I had a really positive response to it. And I felt what it feels like to put yourself out there and be heard. Mm-hmm. And I felt how huge that is. And then when I worked on Feed the Resistance and I worked with all these amazing contributors, I realized I had been pretty tunnel vision about my work. As I mentioned earlier, you know, I just said yes to everything.
Yep.
I didn't think enough, honestly, about whether I was the right person to be saying yes in many occasions. Like, just because I'm asked doesn't mean I should say yes. And I realized how few people get that opportunity. And I wish that was something I had wrapped my head around more before, but, you know, better late than never. Then I just started to just slow down my response a little bit and kind of look around and be like, wait, who else are you asking? Because, like, I've gotten to kind of do this. Like, I don't, you know. And I basically just was like, whoa, you're asking me and, like, 25 million other white people. And that's just not okay. It's not cool. It's also boring. And there's just not a lot of different perspectives. And going back to that thing of like, that means less people get to see themselves reflected. And that's a bummer. So I started being like, you should talk to this person. You should talk to this person. And I just felt like, wow, wouldn't it be great if I could just send people like a link to like a database where you could search by profession or identification and all this stuff. And I was talking to a lot of other friends in food media about this. And everyone was like, yeah, like, that should exist. And I just felt like, well, if it doesn't, like, why don't we just make it happen? Basically, the two steps that I took that were really pivotal was, one, I formed a really wonderful advisory board with colleagues who just had different perspectives than I had. So when it came to coming up with, you know, the list of professions that are on Equity at the Table, when it came to figuring out which words to use for the list of identifications and so on, I had this group of people to talk to. So I wasn't making those decisions alone. That was really important. And the other thing was I hired a totally generous and very smart and capable and quick web developer who built the site and did things that I just have no idea how they work. So I feel like that was also pretty pivotal.
So we also have to talk about your newest book, Simply Julia, 110 Easy Recipes for Healthy Comfort Food, which just came out on March 2nd. In the book, you speak honestly and refreshingly about what this idea of quote unquote healthy is. And in addition to all of the incredible recipes, there is so much to be taken from your reflections and commentary on both society and culture. Why was it important to do this book?
I feel like it was important to do this book because I think it's really, really important to just really consider what we're saying when we say the word healthy and to consider who we're listening to and who we're turning to. And I felt like I had something to offer around this idea of what I think of as healthy comfort food. And for me, it's a really non-judgmental thing. It's a really easygoing thing. And it's something that leaves a lot of room for all of us. And I'm so happy with this book. I'm so excited about it. I think it's, you know, as we've talked at length about, like, I've worked on so many different cookbooks, and this is my most personal one yet. I don't know. My other work has been pretty personal, but this was like really personal. There's a lot of me in this book, and I just felt ready to share some more, I think, and share how my thoughts and feelings have changed about a lot of things, including this idea of like, what is healthy food? And if I could just share one message and nothing else than what we've talked about, to me, the thing that feels really important to say right now is healthy doesn't mean skinny. And I just think I'll just leave that there. Like, that feels really important and worth saying. And
yes.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
I'm sure that you love all the recipes and they're all wonderful. But if you had to pick a favorite, or perhaps like the meatballs, one that is meaningful to you? What recipe really stands out?
Gosh, there's really, like, there are so many in this book. There are a couple of meatball recipes, actually. And one that feels really meaningful to me is this meatball recipe that's based on the meatloaf that my dad used to make when I was growing up. And he would make it often on, like, Saturdays. And the best part was Sunday, having, like, a cold meatloaf sandwich.
Yes.
I don't know if it started because one day, like, we ran out of eggs. I don't know what happened, but typically meatloaf is like ground meat of some kind, eggs and breadcrumbs, and you add the eggs and breadcrumbs to kind of stretch out the meat to get more out of a little. And my dad made meatloaf with a jar of salsa, and then instead of breadcrumbs, he crushed up a bag of corn tortilla chips. And then put like a ton of shredded cheddar cheese in the meatloaf and then some on top of it. And it was just like the best thing. And we all loved it. It was something we all could agree on, which, you know, was kind of rare, like in general. And it brings back this, you know, really kind of fond, happy memory from when I was growing up, which is something I try and capture a lot in my work. And yeah, the thing I switched was I turned it into meatballs, mostly because I'm impatient and meatballs take like a lot less time to cook than meatloaf. Yeah, so that kind of stands out. But there's so many recipes like that. There's a lot of recipes from my mother-in-law in this book, which feels really special. There's recipes from women in my mom's family who are no longer alive. And, you know, I get to kind of carry their torch in this book, which is really special. So it's hard to choose.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are interested in making a switch in their careers. They're interested in expanding what they do, in evolving what they do, but they haven't made that leap quite yet. What advice would you give someone who is standing there thinking about making that jump, thinking about trying something new, but doesn't quite have the courage to do it?
I would say the thing that really comes to mind, and the thing that I'm thinking a lot about for myself, honestly, right now, because I have done a lot of books, and I think I'm actually at this point where I'm thinking about what's next, so maybe you'll have to have me on for an episode of my third life.
Yes, honey.
But the thing that I think about that I would just urge everyone to think about is, you know, if you're considering that kind of change, to really check in with yourself and think about, are you drawn to this maybe romanticized idea of what this thing is? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if someone comes to me and they want to do a cookbook, I really break down all of the work that goes into it and all the stuff that is just truly not glamorous whatsoever. And it's like, does this sound fun to you? Like, and if it does, awesome, let's talk. I'll give you more information. But this is what it is, right? It's not like, yeah, some of us get the chance to go on Second Life. Some of us get the chance to go on NPR, and that's great, but it's an hour of your life. It's not like the years making this thing. So to really check in, is this truly what I want to do? And is this truly how I want to spend my day-to-day life? Because that's all we have. And think about that as much as you're thinking about the idea of what this thing or career might be. So I think really understanding the value of our day-to-day lives is just as important as understanding the value of any perceived career or accolade.
So I also think it's important to talk about mistakes. And we love talking about mistakes on this podcast because we live in an Instagram perfect world where everyone gives it a pretty filter and shows the highlight reel, but that is not real life. So I'm hoping that you can tell me about a mistake that you've made in your career and what you've learned from it.
I mean, I have a lot to choose from. I think going back to what I just said about like your day-to-day life, like I've worked on projects, I've done private chefing, you know, whatever it might be, whatever the work was, I've done it in relationships that have just left me feeling so anxious. And I've stayed because I felt like the reward would be greater than that anxiety. And it's hard to say, I can't go backwards or undo any of that, but I don't think the reward was worth it. I think living with a lot of anxiety is just, if there's an option to be not in that situation, I think it's worth taking it, even if it feels like you might be missing a big opportunity. Because going back to that word healthy, I think unnecessary anxiety is not healthy. And I think that we shouldn't do work that isn't healthy. I think we all deserve to do work that makes us feel good and makes us feel confident and allows us to keep our, you know, self-respect intact.
So, Julia, my last question is my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with a younger Julia and give her some work or career advice, what would you say?
I feel like I talk to my younger self all the time. I feel like I've like brought her up a lot in this podcast. So I think the thing I would say to her, and I think the thing that I often think about, would be so comforting to have known around, I'm thinking specifically like 13, 14, like that kind of age. It would not be career advice at all. I feel like I've always been very career oriented, and
yep,
I would give myself some personal advice and just say, you're going to meet Grace one day and just, it's going to be okay. So I would just tell her that. Yeah.
Julia, thank you so much for this. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. I feel so very extremely grateful for your time and really honored that you would share so much of your story with us.
This is so kind. Thank you.
That was the best-selling cookbook author, home cook, and food equity advocate, Julia Tertian. For more inspiring interviews with women like Julia, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr, the show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.